Should a law in France have an impact on what's considered legal in America? John Witt joins us to talk about Justice Stephen Breyer's new book, The Court and the World, American Law and the New Global Realities.
Judges, jurists have tried desperately to figure out what the Constitution means, and they've made reference to foreign and international experience. They've just had to.
What makes a good coming-of-age novel? Mira Jacob will tell us about her review of three new novels on the shortlist.
Naomi's book and Sarah's book are both about that transformation when you're sort of in a moment and you are turning actively from one person into another. And the world is testing you in that way.
Alexander Alter will fill us in on the latest in the literary world. Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. John Fabian Witt joins us now. He is a professor of law and history at Yale and the author, most recently, of Lincoln's Code, The Laws of War in American History. And this week, he reviews on our cover a new book by Justice Stephen Breyer, The Court and the World, American Law and the New Global Realities. John, welcome.
Hi. Thanks, Pamela. It's good to be here.
This is the latest book from Stephen Breyer, not his first book. What is the book about?
The book's about the way in which Justice Breyer has watched during the course of his career as a justice on the court, and how he's watched international law, foreign law, the world intrude more and more on the experience of being a justice.
And refresh our memories, how long has he been on the court now?
Justice Breyer's been on the court for about two decades now.
Okay, and so is that the period that he's looking at his own direct experience in this with a court in this area?
Yeah, the book has a kind of nice modesty to its method. He looks at what's happened during those two decades and describes more and more stuff going on at the international level.
And you open your review talking about a case from this past June, a death penalty case. What was the case, and what did Breyer write in his dissent that was so significant in terms of international
law? Well, the
case
is about the constitutionality of Oklahoma's new lethal injection protocol. This is arising out of the absence of the old drugs that states used to use for executions. And Justice Breyer, in his dissent, did something kind of interesting. He talked about the experience of foreign countries. He talked about the 137 countries that have abolished the death penalty, either formally or in practice. And he talked about that as a way to make sense of what our Constitution should mean for the death penalty here.
And is this an issue, I mean, bringing up international law in terms of how it might influence and shape American law, is that the only issue he talks about? Or does he also talk about the fact that there are cases where the differences in our law becomes an issue because of the way countries are interconnected?
Well, what he's really interested in, I think, is coordination problems.
Mm-hmm.
He makes the observation that more and more we've got to figure out how our law should relate to foreign law and international law, and how foreign and international law should relate to our law. And he conceives of his role as being a problem solver. That's what cases are, I think, for him. They're opportunities to solve problems. And if you're going to solve problems, then the costs of coordination and the benefits of coordination are front and center. And so he's got those things squarely in view.
So he's not saying, you know, let's go back to the death penalty, that, say, because 137 other countries abolish or don't effectively or in practice use the death penalty, that because of that, that we should change our law in the U.S. He's saying that because they have that law, it creates complications.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess it's certainly true that the fact that so much of the world has abolished the death penalty and we haven't has international feedback, the reputational effects. And I think he would say that those things are relevant, that what one wants to know when one makes a decision as a rational decision maker is the entire universe of relevant things. And foreign experience is going to be one of those things if you want to make intelligent, rational decisions.
And how do the justices, the current justices on the court, split on this particular issue of whether international law should inform American law in some way?
Well, there are four justices who are squarely opposed to it. So Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and Justice Alito are in print as being opposed to making reference to foreign and international law and making sense of the U.S. Constitution. And they've got a powerful argument. I mean, their argument is that democratic self-government requires that we think about our tradition, not someone else's, and that the role of the judge is to be a faithful interpreter of what Americans have done in making our Constitution.
And what's Breyer's counterargument?
I think Breyer's view is that the costs of a kind of navel-gazing, the costs of always looking inside our tradition, are getting greater and greater. There's a long-standing counterargument, which is that if the constitutional tradition made by the people of the United States authorizes looking outside, that's properly understood, authorizes looking outside the American constitutional tradition, then judges are right to look outside the constitutional tradition to make sense of what our commitments are. And Breyer's new argument here is we should step back, and the costs of not looking outside are getting bigger and bigger in a world that's more and more interdependent.
It sounds like, in a way, the argument against having international law sort of affect American law is more ideological in a way. It's more about a principle, and it sounds like Breyer's argument is more pragmatic. Is that correct?
Yeah, Breyer is, I think, the current court's great exemplar of an approach to judging that was really characteristic of, let's call it the legal process school, a group of judges and jurists in the middle of the 20th century who thought of judging as problem solving, as making good judgments. And the pushback from the more conservative justices is a pushback that's arisen after the Warren Court as a reaction to the Warren Court, and that has as its core an originalism theory of constitutional law.
This is an issue that I imagine has become very politicized, that not just on the court, but in the government overall. Are there those who say, you know, we should not listen to what France says on a particular issue? You know, we should actively ignore what other countries rule on these questions, and it should just be the U.S. operating independently?
Yeah, there's definitely a freedom fries aspect to this.
Yes.
That is, there's a kind of patriotic nationalism that comes out. I wouldn't say the justices are driven by that. I think there are really powerful and deep jurisprudential legal theory reasons for the disagreement on the court. But when we look at the politics of Senate confirmations, I think we do start to see politics coming in. And we see senators on both sides of the aisle appealing to particular political constituencies and to and waving flags that make sense to their constituencies.
And one of the things that you bring to the review I thought was interesting is that, as you said earlier, the scope of his book is a very narrow one. He's sort of beginning with his tenure on the court and looking up to today. But you're a historian as well as a law professor, and you point out that there's a long tradition of international law influencing and integrating with American law. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, I think it's really hard to interpret constitutions. I mean, it's really hard work. It's really hard work. We should thank the men and women who do it for a living, for doing it for us. And as a result, since the beginning of the Republic, judges, jurists have tried desperately to figure out what the Constitution means, and they've made reference to foreign and international experience. They've just had to. Partly they did it at the first because there wasn't much of a tradition to rely on.
Mm-hmm.
And then they did it because international and foreign experience has wisdom for us. Helps us make sense of how we might move through the world. So this controversy is really new. It's really new. It's a product of the reaction against the Warren Court and the rise of originalism, which has put the problem on the table.
And you pointed out one interesting example during the Civil War. What happened, a dissenting wing of the court came within a single vote of declaring Lincoln's war powers illegal?
Yeah, the prize is famous case called the prize cases, and the administration is so worried that if they lose this case, the war effort will be done in, that they produce a 10th justice. I mean, they set in motion the appointment of a 10th justice during the moment which the case is about to be decided, to make sure that the court understands it has to come out their way. And what that case involved was the question of whether or not the Lincoln administration could run a blockade. And the blockade was just absolutely critical to the war effort. So the court's been involved in national security stuff, that intersection of the court and of the nation and the world, since way back.
Does this tension between national and international law exist in other countries? Like in the UK, for example, is there a fierce debate and controversy over what is British law versus what is international law?
It's controversial in revolutionary nations, in nations that get started in a self-conscious rejection of some other tradition and want to develop their own tradition. So the United States really is at the core of that project. So most of the countries of the European world don't have that structure. And so there are lots of citations to international and foreign law in the world of international jurists in the 21st century.
Are Supreme Court justices, both sitting justices and former justices, writing more books, or does it just seem that way?
Well, that's interesting. I don't know. I haven't done the empirical study. I think it's a really good thing. You know, one of the problems with the current Supreme Court, the current Courts of Appeals, is and many people have made this observation. You know, there's only one type of person now going on to these courts. There are people who work judges themselves on the Courts of Appeals, mm-hmm. They're not politicians anymore.
Right.
They come from one walk of life in particular. You know, lower court judges, and this is a way for the justices to engage the world and for the world to engage them back. You know, when Stephen Breyer's on Colbert the other day, he's engaged in a conversation with a popular audience not like the kinds he's usually engaged in.
How did he do?
I thought he was great. He was great.
And is the book itself, does it succeed in that way? Is it for a general audience? Did you feel like it was intended for a legal audience to sort of bring new light onto the issue? Or did it seem like he was kind of reaching out to your average American?
It's going to be a little bit of a slog for lay people. It's hard to describe complicated cases, and most of the cases that make their way to the Supreme Court level are pretty complex and intricate. He's really making a good effort at describing them in ways that intelligent readers will be able to make sense of. That's absolutely true. He's doing a good job of that. I don't think it's a page-turner in the way that Justice Sotomayor's memoir is a page-turner, for example, just to think of one recent book. But it is designed for a general audience.
And did you, as a legal, as a law professor, did you learn anything new from the book?
His experience of his tenure on the court, that was an interesting thing to see, and to see the interaction between the battles that he's been in his previous books over active liberty is what the title of his most recent, before this one, battles between that and originalism, and now he's moving those battles over to the international law and foreign law question. And I hadn't made that connection until now.
So in his books, I mean, he's sort of the opposite of the Sotomayor's very personal memoir. He tends to write more seriously about major legal issues.
Yeah, they're not personally revelatory. That is, there's no story in this book where he comes from and how he gets the views that he has. He was a professor at Harvard Law School before he became a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, and that shows. I mean, he writes like a professor dealing with legal cases.
And you heard it from a professor. All right, thanks, John.
Thanks so much, Pamela.
John Fabian Witt is a professor of law and history at Yale. He is also the author of Lincoln's Code, The Laws of War in American History. And this week on our cover, he reviews Stephen Breyer's new book, The Court and the World. Alexander Alter joins us now with notes from the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So what's new?
So literary award season has started for real this week with the Man Booker shortlist and all the National Book Award longlists. There's four categories for the National Book Award: poetry, young adult, fiction, and nonfiction. And as always, there's some overlap and a little bit of controversy with critics divided over the books that were chosen. For the Man Booker shortlist, there's some Americans this year. Ann Tyler's A Spool of Blue Thread was nominated. Hanya Yanagihara's A Little Life was nominated. And then there's the British writer Tom McCarthy, the Jamaican author Marlon James, and the Nigerian author Chigozie Obioma's debut novel, The Fisherman, and the British author Sunjeev Sahota's The Year of the Runaway. So,
how many were cut out?
It was cut down from 13. And I think these were among the favorites of people that were sort of placing bets.
So what are people saying about the short list versus the long list on the Man Booker?
You know, so far I've heard mostly positive responses to sort of the geographic diversity and some of the, you know, the novels that were chosen were considered favorites that were very well reviewed by critics. And there is some overlap, as usual, with the National Book Awards nominees. Hanya Yanagihara was also nominated for the fiction long list for her novel A Little Life. And Bill Clegg's debut novel, Did You Ever Have a Family, made it onto the Booker long list. He was one of the ones that was cut, but he's on the National Book Awards long list for fiction. So
now explain for listeners who are confused by all these awards. The Man Booker Prize was opened to Americans last year for the first time. What about the National Book Awards? Is that only for Americans?
Yes, that's just for works published here by American authors. with the two authors who were highlighted by both of those jury panels, Bill Clegg and Hanya Yanagihara, it's kind of interesting because with all the awards attention focused on those authors, it doesn't necessarily overlap with critics' views. Both of those books have been somewhat polarizing, with some people just saying they're absolutely groundbreaking and phenomenal, and others writing strongly negative reviews. So that's sort of interesting to see a book, you know, two novels that have been somewhat divisive, both making the award circuit this year. Additional works of fiction that were nominated. There were four short story collections nominated this year for the National Book Awards for Fiction, including Edith Perlman's and Adam Johnson's. And another novel that has gotten a ton of love from critics and booksellers is Lauren Groff's The Fates and Furies, or Fates and Furies, which made the long list.
And our cover.
And your cover.
As did the Edith Perlman was on our cover. And I believe, interestingly, the author of Fates and Furies, Lauren Groff, reviewed one of those short story collections, Fortune Smiles by Adam Johnson, in the book review.
Wow.
So we just knew it all in advance and we're just plotting it here.
That's I actually thought the other categories, I thought the nonfiction choices were interesting this year. If you remember, there was some controversy last year because there was only one woman on the nonfiction long list for the National Book Award. And this year,
that was Roz Chast.
That's right. Yep, Roz Chast. And this year, 7 of the 10 authors are women. Those include memoirs by the poet Tracy Smith and by the photographer Sally Mann. And I thought there was a lot of diversity on subject matter on the nonfiction long list this year. Last year it was a little more topical with books about China and Afghanistan. And this year there's a book about rain by Cynthia Barnett and another book that sounds fascinating about the inner lives of octopuses by Cy Montgomery. So I think there are some good choices.
Cephalopods were big this past year. There's
it's
another
been
book
a huge
on
year for cephalopods. We'll see if he wins.
All right. Other news is a bit closer to home. Here at the New York Times, we have a new critic for the New York Times Daily Book Review. Jennifer Senior was announced today. Alexander, tell us a little bit about Jennifer Senior.
This is very exciting for us here that Jennifer is coming. She is the author of a book, All Joy and No Fun, which is a hilarious and in-depth look at modern parenting. As a parent, I thoroughly enjoyed. And she writes for New York Magazine. And she's going to join us as a daily book critic here. I think she has a broad interest in both fiction and nonfiction. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of books she's picking and what her opinions are.
Readers of the Book Review will be familiar with Jennifer Senior's work. She most recently reviewed Steve Silberman's book, Neurotribes, for us, but she has run the gamut. She also reviewed Christopher Hitchens' memoir, Hitch 22, and so we are looking forward to seeing her around here a lot more.
Me too.
All right. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks, Pamela.
Mira Jacob is here now. She is the author of The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing, and this week she reviews 3 coming-of-age novels for us on the shortlist. Hi, Mira.
Hi.
So let's just talk quickly, go over the titles of these books. The Star Side of Bird Hill by Naomi Jackson, Animals by Emma Jane Unsworth, and Dryland by Sarah Jaffe. Did the three books, we describe them as coming-of-age novels. In what ways are they each coming-of-age novels?
It's a good question because I would say 2 of them really fell into that category. Naomi's book and Sarah's book are both about that time, that sort of the transformation when you're sort of in a moment and you are turning actively from one person into another, and the world is testing you in that way. Emma's book was not, actually. It was interesting because it's about a woman in her 30s and she's, frankly, she's
immature.
She's immature. And she's kind of unwilling to change. She does go through a transformation, but it is a long time coming. And there's something that reads a little bit strangely about it. She's not at the mercy of anything but herself. It feels a little less coming of age and slightly more indulgent than.
All right. Let's start to talk specifically about The Star Side of Bird Hill by Naomi Jackson. This is a debut novel as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
What's it about?
What it's about is 2 girls who are sent to live with their grandmother in Barbados after they have survived a pretty traumatic winter with their mother. Their mother is depressed. She's unable to take care of herself. She's unable to take care of them. And as a result, their lives have really
gone wild, and they are in survival mode when they land in Barbados.
How old are they?
One is 14 and the other is 10. So Dion is 14 and Phaedra is 10.
And they're coming from Brooklyn.
And they're coming from Brooklyn. And they're coming from winter. And they're coming from a moment when they've been starved of love and consistency and faith in the world. And so when you meet them, they are both incredibly resilient because of what they've been through, but also deeply fragile. And it's really interesting to see that because you see where they are strong and where they are weak. And what in them needs some love. And it's kind of amazing to watch them grow into who they are in Barbados.
And so does the rest of the novel take place then in Barbados?
It does.
Or does it circle back to Brooklyn?
It never goes back to Brooklyn. And the thing that I thought she did so well is it never goes back to the missing mother. She haunts the book the way that a missing mother would. And you feel her. You feel the echoes of her through everything and that kind of deep sadness that you would have in that moment. But you never get the satisfaction of seeing her the way that they will never get the satisfaction of reconciling with her. And it works well.
And to what extent is the book about the cultural differences between Barbados and Brooklyn?
You know, it's about the cultural differences, but I would also say it is more about the legacy of loss and how that travels from Barbados to Brooklyn to these two girls who have very little idea what their history is, but are living out these dynamics that have come through their family because of everything they faced in the generations before. So I wouldn't say it's as much about the contrasts as what we live with, the legacies that we are given from our families and our histories.
In your review, you said Jackson gestures towards the legacy of slavery in Barbados and the weight of cultural inheritance.
Yes.
Is that a dominant theme in the book?
It's a theme she works up to. I wouldn't say it's dominant. It really does feel more like a coming-of-age story about girls that have lost their mothers, but it's a reveal in the book, certainly.
The author herself has an interesting background. She studied fiction at the Iowa's writer workshop, so that maybe is not quite so unusual, but also traveled to South Africa on a Fulbright. And it sounds like she has sort of dealt with race in an international context.
Yes.
In her real life, and then works with that in the novel.
Absolutely. It feels like a story that is both close to home but global in scope.
And can you explain the title at all without giving anything away, The Star Side of Bird Hill?
It's where they are. It's the place that they are, the place they come to in Barbados. It's literally the place they come to transform.
All right. Let's talk about a very different book. As you said, not quite a coming-of-age novel in the traditional sense, but Emma Jane Unsworth's book,
yeah.
Animals. This is not a first novel. This is her second book. Had you read her first book?
I hadn't read her first book. And I have to tell you, it was a delight to read this. She's very funny. Very, very funny. And the writing is quirky and it is engaging and it is really interesting. So I was pulled in right away and I stayed with it till the end, pretty much just, you know, turning the pages. It's very digestible. But also, she's unusual. Her take is unusual.
So the author, Emma Jane Unsworth, is she American?
English.
She's British. Okay. Mm-hmm. And does the story takes place in Manchester?
Yes, it does.
So what's this about?
This is about best friendship. And I don't know if I've read a book that is quite so good at describing what happens in the best friendship of women and how you can sort of build each other up and tear each other down in the exact same breath. She does it. I know people kind of hint at that in many other books, but she does it with there's a slightly more bodiness to it. There's more urgency to it. There's more honesty to it. And that part of her writing is so strong. That you find yourself having as a woman. I found myself having a visceral reaction to certain passages and remembering what it is like when we sort of fall in love with our best female friends.
It's interesting because this book is published by Europa Editions, which is the same publisher who published all of the Elena Ferrante books.
Yes.
Which are also so much about friendship. So who knows what's going on there with an editor.
And I loved the Ferrante books. This is a seamier side of friendship. It is just as complicated and just as nuanced, but it feels very modern and abrasive at points and reckless.
All right. It sounds like Dryland, the third novel in your roundup by Sarah Jaffe, is very different in voice.
It is. I likened her to a less caustic Janice Johnson. She has a great quality to her writing, which is that it is very of the body. you're very in the body of the narrator as she moves through her world.
And this is a 15-year-old girl.
15-year-old girl who is sort of, she's trying to be a swimmer. Her brother was a champion swimmer. He was an Olympic hopeful. He's disappeared. Not disappeared. You know that he's alive and he's in Europe. But he's sort of haunting the family. His disappearance haunts the family, and so does the reason why he disappeared. It comes out pretty quickly. You start to understand very quickly that sexuality is at the center of the story. His sexuality and then her sexuality. And so it's about being gay in the 90s, and it's about figuring that out.
Is it about her discovery?
It's about her discovery, and she does that beautifully. She does that really well because you, reading it, understand pretty quickly that she's gay, but you see her understanding it little by little, and it does seem like she is literally opening a package and pulling out something and saying, oh my God, this belongs to me. And it's amazing to see that happen. That's when I was enjoying it the most, was her discovery of that moment and how real it felt. There was something that I found missing in the novel, and I will admit that I am a person that really likes to see a trajectory, really likes to see a turn of character or a plot maneuver, something that really breaks the story open.
Mm-hmm.
And in the moment when I felt like the story was about to break open, it did with the plot, but it didn't in emotional narrative. It didn't in urgency. I didn't know what was happening inside the character.
Well, in a coming-of-age novel, that seems especially problematic because so much of coming-of-age is about what happens inside.
Exactly. Exactly. And it was funny because I found myself at this sort of breathless moment waiting, you know, like waiting for the rain. And it didn't come. And I was surprised by that choice because she sets it up so well. And there's nothing in the previous narrative that makes you think, oh, she's going to be a person that's going to be able to talk about her emotions. And yet you expect it because she has made this, she's gone through this transition. You expect something from her internal.
One of the interesting things about coming of age novels that often comes up in discussions with writers and readers is, you know, is it a young adult novel or a children's novel if it's a coming of age novel? And what makes a coming of age novel not a children's book?
Mm-hmm.
Because coming of age is obviously a major theme in children's literature. Did any of these feel to you like children's books, or were these very much adult coming of age novels?
Dryland felt slightly more YA because it didn't follow through on the emotional arc it had set up, because it chose to kind of pull a screen down in that moment.
Although you're making a dangerous statement for the YA crowd who will say, it didn't come through and therefore it's YA.
No. Okay. All right. Let me backtrack then and say, what I mean is I felt like there was going to be a layer of real exploration, the kind of exploration that haunts adult novels.
And you need, frankly, that perspective.
Yeah, and that sort of jump, out of just her body and into the sort of larger ramifications of what she was thinking in a broader way. And I know that's true, that does happen in many YA novels too. I find it slightly more circumspect in YA novels than it is in adult novels, where the weight of that discovery sometimes really bangs out through the entire narrative, and you feel it, you feel the ramifications of it in a very adult way.
Did you have a favorite among the three books?
Yeah, I'm going to have to say it was Naomi Jackson's. She was telling a story that I have known through my life exists in a lot of places. It's a story of immigration and the losses that you carry with you. And I've seen it, but I haven't seen it like this. I felt like she was trying out something new, and she was doing it in a light way.
This book came out actually earlier in the summer, and I remember it coming up in discussions when someone or another had, you know, come up with a list of books that was not terribly diverse. And Naomi Jackson's novel was pointed out as one of the many books coming from African-American writers that dealt with that experience that, you know, wasn't necessarily getting attention everywhere, and that this was telling a new kind of narrative. So it's interesting that that also struck you.
Well, you know, I think the thing that I find so often now is that there is a whole silent world of us that know these stories and that grew up on these stories, and they live in us, and we don't see them in the public. And when we do, it's this one book, and everyone will talk about this one book.
Right.
But these stories, we are carrying them around with us, and we are hoping to see ourselves in anything. So when you see something like that and it's done well, you think, oh, sweet Jesus, there it is, the one that we all know. And yet she did it really well, and she did it in a fresh way.
Let's talk about the book that you're working on yourself. Your last novel was The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing, but you're working on a graphic memoir.
I'm working on a graphic memoir. It's called Good Talk, and it came out of a series of conversations. So I draw a lot. Sometimes when I can't write, I draw instead. And what I've started doing lately is drawing two characters and the conversations that they've had, and sometimes they are just baffling. For example, my son was obsessed with Michael Jackson, and he started asking me a lot about race and color because he was obsessed with Michael Jackson. And it was at the time that Ferguson, everything that was happening with Ferguson was on the TV. So one of the pieces that I did was when he was obsessed with Michael Jackson, he came to me and he said, "So, Mommy, is Michael Jackson brown or is he white?" And I said, "Oh, that's a really good question. The crazy thing is he kind of started brown and then he turned white." And he said, "He turned white?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Are you going to turn white?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Am I?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Daddy?" And I said, "Daddy's already white." And he said, "But was he always?"
Oh.
And I realized that I had kind of done this thing to his poor brain, which was to break it in a conversation. So the premise of this book is that conversation doesn't always clear things up. In fact, sometimes it makes things much more confusing, but I'm sort of going for all the conversations that have left me the most baffled and somewhat inspired by what happens in life.
I'm going to use this moment to bring up one of my favorite Michael Jackson in a graphic memoir scenes, which was from Marjane Satrapi's Persepolis, where she shows the street sellers selling bootleg cassettes, and one of them is offering Yikel Maxon. Which is just perfect. Well, we'll look forward to your graphic memoir, Good Talk. When is that coming out?
I don't know. I've got to finish it yet.
All right. Well, something to look forward to. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Mira Jacob. She is the author of The Sleepwalker's Guide to Dancing. And this week she reviews three coming-of-age novels on the shortlist in the book review. This week on the website, I wrote a bit about the history of the New York Times Book Review podcast and the fact that it is apparently now one of the biggest podcasts at the Times, if not the biggest. And that is courtesy or credit to one person, Sam Tannenhaus, who just happened to wander into the building today. And so our special surprise guest is Sam. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Pamela and Jocelyn, our great producer. And full disclosure here, I read that fantastic piece by Pamela, and I started waxing nostalgic about it. So I essentially kind of shoehorned myself in here so we can walk down memory lane together.
Well, and you credited the podcast to Dwight Garner.
Yes. For listeners who care about any of this, Dwight Garner was a brilliant editor at the New York Times Book Review for some 10 years before he became the great daily critic you know him to be. And it was Dwight who said, "Let's do a podcast." At that point, I don't think I'd ever heard one. This is, Pamela, maybe 2005 or 6.
Right.
Because it took a little while to develop and gestate or whatever verb you're supposed to use. Dwight thought it was something we should do. And it's interesting because his original conception of it was much different from what it became. Because at that point, podcasts were almost like readings, bookstore readings. Like his idea was we would have an author maybe read for 20 minutes from a book, and then we would do some conversation around it. And the idea that it would be this kind of fast-paced, newsy thing just developed over time.
So did you ever do that, a reading aloud on the podcast, or did that die before inception?
We have had some people read briefly. I think almost always fiction writers. And even that just doesn't work somehow. You know this.
Yes.
What people want is a conversation. They don't want, you know, this great phrase Saul Bellow had in an interview he gave many years ago. He said, "Look, let's not talk about how I sharpen my pencils," right?
Right.
So people don't really want that kind of thing. They want to get kind of inside the head of a writer, but in a way that they can relate to their own conception of how books are important and why they matter, and also to their own lives. And that comes through more of just a direct conversation, like
so
the kind you do.
In the olden days of the podcast, was it hard to kind of get authors to understand what this podcast thing was and to get people to come in and come on the show?
It was not hard because people were mystified and fascinated. And I tell everybody this story of And I think you wrote about it, Pamela. The very first guest, you reminded me it was the first, was an excellent novelist and really funny guy, Gary Steingart, who came in. And in those days, we're in the building on 43rd Street, what we all now call the old building, and we did it in my
office.
It's
a Yahoo building now.
It is? Yes. I did not know that.
So it is really a new building.
So it's come around. Good for the Times, good for Yahoo. Well, we used to do it in my office, and Gary came in. But before he showed up, Dwight had sent him a note and said, would you be interested in doing a podcast? And Steingart replied, yes, or at least in finding out what one is. And I remember when we invited Tina Brown, who is great, as you can imagine, because she's so dynamic and well-spoken. I sent her a note and said, would you like to come in and do the podcast? She'd written her book about Princess Diana, which is actually quite a remarkable book and reviewed on our cover, very
Who reviewed it?
I believe it was Caroline Weber who did it. And I think they actually became friends at that point. She really admired him. So I sent Tina a note and I said, would you like to come in and do the podcast? And she replied, I wish I could remember verbatim what she wrote. It was an email. But all these puns and jokes off the idea of pods, of casting, you know, will it take seed and sprout somewhere, this kind of thing.
It was like when Weblog was launched.
Yes. Well, you know, it was Dwight who wrote the first blog for the book review, and that was the web editor, Mick Sussman's idea that we should do it and Dwight should do it. And then Dwight again who had the idea that we should do the podcast. So that's when we were kind of coming out of the dark ages a little bit.
And you liked it from the beginning.
Yes. Well, initially it was really awkward. We had no idea how to do it. So I would write scripts and I would begin each one with a really dumb joke. And then people out there in the blogosphere said, not always in the kindest way, because that's how the blogosphere works, maybe you shouldn't be doing that anymore. And I think one of the editors here, great editor, culture editor at the time, John Landman, who helped set it up, said, I like the podcast. I even like Sam's corny, really bad jokes. So they went out, and then it became straight conversation. And we came up with the format pretty quickly, though, which is to have the books reporter come in. It was either, in those days, Motoko Rich and then Julie Bosman. Leslie Kaufman did it for a while. I think Alexandra does it for you now. And then also drew the bestseller list. And originally, that was Dwight. Dwight was really funny on the bestseller list.
Yes.
And then Jenny Schuessler was great with it, too. And she would do these very quick, snarky kind of one-liners. And hers would be scripted. Dwight's was not. So you saw the different ways people worked. And Jocelyn will remember all of this, that we just kind of adapted to each person's style. And I was basically like ringmaster. Which
I'm tempted to like have Jocelyn pull together a reel of those corny jokes. What do you say?
Oh, no, please don't.
One of our new blog posts.
You mentioned one about my daughter's orthodonture.
I did.
And my daughter is now about to turn 24, you know. It found some kind of audience. We were a boutique-y novelty act for book geeks, and you've made it glamorous in your own glamorous way, and that's fantastic.
Well, we won't fight over it, but let's just do some of those annoying questions that nobody ever wants to answer, but I'm going to make you. Who is your favorite guest?
My favorite guest? Well, I hate to say it, because it was one moment when Jocelyn was not able to do the recording. And I said, only for the name-dropping frisson, Keith Richards, which we did in the telephone. And what was great about it was he was a really good interview. And we did it in this room or right nearby. Is he was in one of his palatial mansions. I think he lives in New Canaan, Connecticut or something, which is the wealthiest per capita city in America. And we were supposed to interview him at 3 o'clock on the phone. And I thought, well, this is Keith Richards. We'll be lucky if we hear from him 7 hours later. But at 3 p.m. on the dot, he himself phoned in and I was late. So I said, all right, this time we will not do it on Keith time. We'll do it on Sam time. So he was great. Another guest who's really, really good because she could do the most difficult of all things is Francine Prose. Once gave an interview, a conversation about fiction. Mm-hmm. That's about as good as I've heard. It's really hard to talk about fiction. And she could do it. A.O. Scott, the film critic, back when he was doing a lot of book criticism as well,
right,
did a brilliant thing for us when we'd had a big survey It was kind of a stunt. What's the best American novel of the last quarter century? And Tony had written the kind of overview essay for it, and he came in and went through it.
He has a big book coming out on the art of criticism.
He is so gifted, as you know. And my final favorite guest, and I almost wrote about this in response to your piece, in some ways the most comprehensively brilliant, was Ian McEwan. And that was, again, done in my old office fairly early on. His little novella, Chesil Beach, had come out. And McEwan had agreed to do the podcast, but he was jet-lagged. He'd flown in the night before from London. He still agreed to do it. And he came in, and three of us, Bob Harris, who was the deputy editor then, Dwight, who was our senior editor, and I all kind of did a tag-team interview with him. He did Darwinism and the history of science. He did the art of the novel. He did John Updike's Sentences and why he admires them so much. It was really remarkable, we thought.
He's an amazing public speaker.
He's a great public speaker. He's a really brilliant mind, which novelists don't necessarily have. Some of them do. Jonathan Franzen is a brilliant mind. But you don't need a brilliant mind to be a great writer. He happens to have one. And we were very proud of it. We spoke to him for 45 minutes or something. And of course, we had to make it much shorter. And somebody here at the Times who was supervising the podcast said, we didn't like it too much. It was too insidery. So that was a real lesson for us, that what might seem really stimulating and rich to us might not play the same way for somebody outside our little circle.
Was there one question that you always like to ask guests?
I liked to ask them how many drafts and revisions they did. Because the answers are surprising. I think a lot of people don't grasp how hard writers work. You're an author. I'm an author. We've written books for better and worse, and it's really, really hard work. So I like to ask fiction writers that, and I asked Jennifer Egan, who's one of our really finest novelists, that how many drafts will you put something through? And her book Goon Squad had come out, which was a real triumph. And she said, well, there are some sections here that I wrote 79 or 80 times.
Oh my God.
And I almost fell out of my chair. I just couldn't believe it. And she just said it in this very direct way. So that I found good. Also, what they like to read, I think it's helpful for listeners. Novelists read differently from nonfiction writers, as your listeners may know. Novelists tend to read everything by a particular author.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas
it's a study.
Yes, it is. And a total immersion. Yeah, it is a study. That's a little different maybe from what we'll do, where we want to read a great novel by Trollope. Okay, now we think we kind of get Trollope. You know, you read
Blake House. Now you're describing the journalist's way of reading.
Well, you know.
We cherry pick.
And so you learn a lot from that.
So what are you reading right now?
I don't read. I reread. I go back to the same old things. And people tell me sometimes, they say, gee, you seem to have a good memory. And I'll say, no, I just happen to have read this thing 96 times. So I'm now rereading Edmund Wilson's To the Finland Station, because I'm working myself on a book, a biography of William F. Buckley, that has a lot of ideas in it. And it's really hard to write about ideas in an interesting way. And Into the Finland Station, which is Edmund Wilson's book about the rise of socialism and how theories of equality or social justice turned into the communist movement, it's filled with narrative about arguments and ideas. So I've been rereading that. I'm also rereading Richard Ellman's biography of James Joyce, because that was the first biography I read that made me realize biography could be an art form.
Have you read his Oscar Wilde also?
I have.
I love that.
I loved it. Absolutely loved it. And when I was working on Whitaker Chambers, which was my biography I wrote many years ago, alas now, I would alternate reading Ellman's Wilde with David McCullough's Truman, because that was his big book.
Both great.
Because McCullough showed you how you do it. Ellman is this great Olympian figure. He's the great favored biographer of other literary biographers. He's a great literary artist. McCullough is a maestro of the craft of telling the story of somebody's life.
Yeah.
So I would read McCullough to see how you do it, and then read Ellman for this kind of high inspiration. And also his footnotes. He's really good at footnotes and endnotes.
How is the Buckley bio coming?
Well, it's coming. I'm pleased to say it's a difficult but stimulating book to write. And he is a really important guy who's also really protean. He took so many different shapes. He's kind of hard to bottle and, you know, present, you know, like poor Eleanor Rigby's face in the jar. It's a lot harder to do with Buckley. So it's a challenge, as we say, but very stimulating one.
All right. Well, I'm sure you'll be on the podcast when that comes out, but hopefully before then. Again, thanks so much, Sam.
Thanks so much, Pamela. We're so proud of you here.
Greg Coles is here now with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
Well, on the fiction side, there are four new titles, starting with a familiar name down at number 15. J.A. Jantz is back on the list with Dance of the Bones. Then at number 12, another familiar name, Robert B. Parker, who died a long time ago but has remained prolific. Reed Farrell Coleman is continuing Robert B. Parker's series with Robert B. Parker's The Devil Wins, new at number 12. Then at number 9, Salman Rushdie is on the hardcover fiction list with 2 years, 8 months, and 28 nights, which is, for the mathematically inclined, it amounts to 1,001 nights. This is kind of his modern updating of the Arabian Nights, the whole epic fantasy about the battle between faith and reason.
And he's also our By the Book this week. I think Salman Rushdie may be one of the most well-read people I know. I was once at an event in New York where there was a kind of quiz for the audience, and it was a very literate and literary group. And the only one to get all of the answers correct was Salman.
All right.
So
we
read
also
what
know
he
that,
reads.
Including Barack Obama, which we know from his By the Book, he really enjoyed.
But apparently generally avoids books by politicians.
Yeah, he says he passed up Donald Trump's book. Then finally, new at number one this week, Lee Child is back with another Jack Reacher novel. This one's called Make Me, and it debuts right at the top of the list.
But there are some mainstays on the bestseller list fiction. Girl on the Train, still on there. All the Light We Cannot See, still on there.
Yeah, Girl on the Train has now spent 35 weeks on the list. It's there at number 4, which is actually an improvement from last week. It's jumped up a couple of spots. All the Light We Cannot See, 71 weeks on the list. And another mainstay down at number 13, Kristen Hanna, The Nightingale, has now spent 32 weeks on the list.
We're not seeing that kind of longevity on the nonfiction side.
No, the only book that's been on the nonfiction side for more than 30 weeks is Atul Gawande's Being Mortal, which is at number 5. The others have all been knocked off by new and recent books, including 4 new titles this week. Down at number 13, Timothy Snyder's Black Earth, his look at the Holocaust, is new at number 13. We reviewed that recently.
And Jenny Schuessler did an interesting story on him in the Arts Pages. He's kind of a controversial historian, and this book, I think, is not going to change that. It's a new interpretation of the Holocaust that centers on the idea of ecological crisis.
Right. How Hitler was able to mobilize Germany to get behind the Holocaust and exactly looking at environmental causes.
He overlapped with me in the history department at college.
Interesting.
Yes.
Another book that we recently reviewed at number 12, Dale Rusikoff's The Prize, which looks at school reform in Newark, New Jersey. That's new on the list at number 12.
You know, every time people say that education books don't sell, there goes another education book on the bestseller list. So
who says they don't sell?
The they of the publishing industry.
Up at number 8, Nadia Boltz-Weber, a Lutheran pastor who used to be a stand-up comic. She's a very unconventional minister. She's 6'1". She's covered with tattoos, mostly of like stained glass windows and religious scenes. And she runs a church in Denver called the House for All Saints and Sinners, or All Sinners and Saints. She caters to kind of outsiders, but she holds to a fairly conservative theology that really believes in sin and grace. And she hit the list, at least the extended list, a few years ago with a memoir that she wrote called Pastrix. This book is called Accidental Saints, new at number 8, and it looks at people who you might not expect to find religion or to represent grace, in some cases they're not religious people themselves. They're agnostics who are just kind of questing. But she is looking at outsiders and how they can represent her view of religion.
All right. Another outsider of sorts on the list?
Yeah. At number seven, new on the list this week, Chrissy Hynde, the longtime lead singer and frontwoman of The Pretenders, has a memoir called Reckless. And she talks about growing up in Akron, Ohio, and getting away from her her middle-class conservative family and into a life of sex and drugs and rock and roll.
If you are a female rock star, it seems now is the time to write your memoir.
There are a lot of female rocker memoirs coming out. Maybe Patti Smith got the ball rolling back with Just Kids, which won the National Book Award in 2010. But there's suddenly been a wave. Kim Gordon from Sonic Youth hit the bestseller list earlier this year. Viv Albertine from The Slits also had a memoir last year. Carrie Brownstein's about to come out with a memoir, not just about her life in rock and roll, but also her life in acting and her life in general.
Well, and it all comes back to Patti Smith again. She's got another book coming out later this month.
Yes, she does. M-Train, a second memoir.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.